Welcome back. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, La Rage du Peuple, special programming, looking at struggles of social justice around the world and here locally in Montreal. So we're going to move into talking about the situation in Mexico, an uprising in Oaxaca, which occupied the attention of lots of activists on the ground here in Montreal and around the world with La Otra Campaña and others. We have in the studio, in addition to Sarita, who's going to stick around, she has several years of experience organizing in the Mexican situation as well. We have Jose, who is with La Otra Campaña and Radio Sabotaje in Mexico City. I think I mangled that pronunciation. How do I pronounce it? Instead of laughing, you should correct it. How do you say it?
Radio Sabotaje.
All right. But before speaking with Jose, speaking some more with Sarita, I'm going to run some audio here, an interview that I did with somebody who was present at the uprising in Oaxaca. She was there during the repression. Her name is Baruca Calamity Peller. I spoke to her on December 29th. I actually spoke to her from Chiapas, where she's attending the Intergalactica, which is happening now as we speak. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit as well. Anyway, she has 4 years of experience organizing with anti-authoritarian collectives in Mexico, and she was present in Oaxaca this year during the repression. So I had a chance to talk with Baruca about her impressions of the resistance in Oaxaca. And we'll go to that interview right now. All right, I'm speaking with Baruca Calamity Peller, who has been active with anti-authoritarian collectives in Mexico for the past 4 years. She was in Oaxaca, where there was a widely defended popular uprising, as well as repression by the state authorities and paramilitary. I'm speaking with Baruca in Chiapas right now. Welcome, Baruca.
Hi.
Baruca, it seems, observing from afar the uprising in Oaxaca in the past several months, that the role of the barricades basically defines this uprising. And I know you've written about that. So could you speak more about barricades and why they are so essential to understanding what this uprising is all about?
Well, I mean, the barricades played a logistical role, as well as a symbolic role, and a role that really kind of played out the psychology that was happening in the minds of the majority of the population of the Oaxacan state, protection for the people in Oaxaca, and a way for them to be able to control what was going on in their own neighborhoods. The Ulises Ruiz, who was ousted by the popular uprising, had his supporters and had paramilitaries and police in civilian uniforms who would go into the neighborhoods where people were collectively participating in the uprising and carry out assassinations and disappearances. So by decades, people were able to kind of control what was going on in their neighborhoods and have some measure of security. And also the barricades, they stopped business as usual and created a situation of ungovernability. And what ungovernability meant in Oaxaca was not only a strategy to use against the state government to get Ulises out of power, because if the federal government deemed that Oaxaca was ungovernable, then they would have to have a process in dealing with taking out Ulises, but also ungovernability for people in Oaxaca meant that as long as they weren't governed, they weren't repressed, and that it was a way of showing the disillusion of power and the breakdown of power structures and the authoritative class in Oaxaca. And so that's what the barricades provided, was a state of ungovernability, and at the same time, a very sane and, clear state of living for the people in the neighborhoods where the barricades were, where they could control their own lives at the same time as preventing others, i.e. the state, from controlling their lives. The barricades, they played this type of role, before the entrance of the federal preventive police in the very end of October. They played a role in which, that really showed on the ground autonomous, decentralized organizing, because the barricades were a place where people would get together and organize with other people from their neighborhoods. And there was nobody who could really control what the neighborhoods, what decisions were coming out of the barricades in the neighborhoods. And so there was no opportunity for any type of vanguardist group to take a hold of the oppo and start controlling people. And that this is really where the idea of the revolution from below comes from, that the people, you know, who are there, who are, you know, living in the neighborhoods, are controlling what is going on in the neighborhoods and controlling and directing their own lives. And so that's the type of role that the barricades played. Of course, later on, there are, you know, PRD party elements in the oppo. The PRD party is the Partido Revolucionario Democrático that has had, you know, the leftist stance in electoral politics in Mexico. You know, they are the quasi-leftist party whose candidate for presidency, Obrador, got frauded out of the presidency this summer. And so there are PRD party elements within the oppo who, you know, such as Flavio Sosa, who was one of the oppo spokespeople, who said that, you know, towards the end, especially when the PFP were entering into Oaxaca City, the preventive federal police, and when they were there, who was saying that the barricades no longer played a tactical role, and that the barricades should be taken down. Some people believe that this actually has to do with him negotiating with the federal government so that they wouldn't carry through with his federal warrants, et cetera. And then maybe there was, like, some other political, you know, intentions or negotiations going on behind. There was, you know, a little bit of controversy about the barricades inside of the oppo, and that there was people who wanted, you know, to see the barricades removed, very few people within the oppo. And the people at the barricades said, you know, we're not negotiating out the barricades with the government, so barricades aren't for negotiation, they're not for sale, you know, as the, even as the government was trying to negotiate with them to get rid of the barricades to create a situation which it seemed like Oaxaca was governable. You know, and the people at the barricades were the people who had the last say, and that was really what's amazing about Oaxaca, that it was always the people on the ground who had the last say in what happened with their lives and you know, in decisions concerning the barricades and decisions being made on the ground.
Baruca, you've described the importance of the barricades in the uprising, but can you describe? I know you've been at those barricades. Can you describe what that's like? Describe the day to day, night to night rhythm of those barricades. Describe how it sounds, how it feels, how it looks like for those of us who haven't been there.
Well, when I entered into Oaxaca, I came in a few days after the preventive federal police had come in to occupy the city and try to put down the uprising. And, you know, thousands and thousands of preventive federal police came in and evicted many of the barricades. At that point, there had been, you know, around 3,000 barricades throughout the city, and the federal preventive police came in and violently evicted most of the barricades, and then they occupied the Zocalo, the center square of the city. And so there was one barricade remaining, one very major barricade surrounding the university and the university city, the Autonomous University Benito Juarez of Oaxaca. And so that was the last barricade remaining, and what it was, its function was to not only defend the autonomy of the university, but also to defend the university radio, which was the last remaining oppo-controlled radio that had been evicted by the federal preventive police. And so, you know, that was the barricade that I lived at, and like I said, it was the last remaining barricade. About 2,000 to 3,000 federal preventive police attempted to evict that barricade as well on November 2nd, and literally only hundreds of people were available to defend barricade. People came from the neighborhoods, from inside the university, students, anarchists, these types, and they successfully caused the police to retreat on November 2nd, even though the police had three helicopters throwing tear gas, water tanks, and were heavily armed. Protesters armed, only a few hundred protesters armed with sticks and stones were able to cause them to retreat. So that barricade was called the Barricade of Victory, and it had a lot of repercussions at that point after the preventive federal police had come in. It had a lot of repercussions morally and politically and strategically on the continuing and the ability of people to continue uprising despite the presence of the federal police there. And so also when the federal police came in, the PRI supporters, the paramilitaries, the civilians paid off by the government of Ulises Ruiz and the state government felt empowered to carry out more violence against the popular uprising. And so when I was at the barricades, you know, there was many mornings in which we would awake to gunshots flying over our heads, gunshots into the universities, attacks carried out by death squads in trucks that would surround the barricades and try to intimidate people. And in fact, there's a 20-year-old student who was shot in the hip and remained in grave condition one morning in early November. And so, you know, the barricades were very tense, but as well there was a high morale from having caused police to retreat, you know, right there on the last frontier of the Oppo barricades. And, you know, people lived communally, communal cooking, stuff like this, consensus-based decisions made at the barricades. There's also street children living at the barricades who, you know, were eating very well and had clothes and were taken care of and were having fun and stuff like this. And really, like, a festive atmosphere. People really, like, you know, feeling like they had an autonomous space and a place to, in which to organize and to live and to know each other. And you know, is very very horizontally organized. But, yes, there was a lot of tension, a lot of oppression during November, you know. What would happen is people would leave the barricades to walk towards town or something like this, and one by one they were getting picked off and disappeared or violently arrested by police. And there were several actions carried out by police or paramilitaries against the barricades that created just quite a scene of tension and insecurity. But people, you know, despite the gunshots and despite the repression, people stayed there and they defended their barricade and they were always there and they were always organizing and, you know, and working on the barricade and making sure that it would remain.
Baruca, the immediate pretext for the uprising was the police attack in June on teachers who were encamped in Oaxaca. And as a result of that, there was all kinds of events and incidents that made up this uprising. And one in particular that I want to ask you about is the August 1st takeover by women of Channel 9 television station, forcing that station to broadcast footage of the bloody events on June 14th. So I'm wondering if you could talk about the role of women in this uprising. You've also written about marches by the women who are in this uprising, and you've talked about the patriarchal dynamics of APO. So could you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, in my opinion, the women have certainly had the most active and combative and consistent voice within the Oaxaca uprising. You know, like you said, it was women who took over Canal 9, and they didn't, you know, exactly force the station to play footage as much as they took over the station and began to run the station themselves. And the way they ran it was in a very intelligent manner. You know, they didn't know how to use the equipment inside the station, but they taught themselves how to use it and then began to teach other people how to use the equipment. And then they began to broadcast stories about the Zapatistas, about the Siege of Anzanco, which was another time that the federal government, you know, attempted to put down an uprising there. And there was a lot of brutality carried out. And, you know, they talked a lot about other political situations happening across Mexico, and so the people in Oaxaca who were watching began to feel that they were part of a bigger context and they weren't alone. And so they really provided a window through which people could view what was happening around the country, you know, and a window that showed the context of their own lives and gave people an understanding of why, you know, uprising is necessary and stuff like this. And certainly, you know, the women have been carrying out several marches right now after the repression in the 25th, when a lot of the movement in Oaxaca had to go into hiding, when a lot of the movement is very dispersed and displaced from the repression that is being carried out still to this day in Oaxaca. It is women's groups who seem to still be organizing and who still seem to be very active. And, you know, the women, you know, there's never been really a feminist movement in in Mexico like there has been in the United States, for instance. And so there hasn't really been this type of a process where people are questioning from the beginning why there isn't more participation of women, or why some groups aren't diversified on gender lines. And so the women really took things into their own hands and said, you know, we're not waiting for our husbands to tell us that we can leave the house now and participate. No, we're going to go back to the barricades, and we're going to be at the barricades, and we're going to take over, you know, the media stations.
Since the formation of APO, the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, earlier this year, the APO has been seen, at least from the outside, as synonymous with this uprising. But one observation that you've made is that maybe we shouldn't see APO as synonymous with the uprising. It's not necessarily your observation, but something you've recounted that has been said by other people. So can you maybe explain why the APO isn't necessarily synonymous with this uprising?
Well, you know, the APO is like, it's just an infrastructure, really. It's just like a kind of an umbrella group. It's a place in which to organize. But, you know, there's no force within the APO that can oversee another force within the APO. You know, even if the PRD party tries to take a lot of control over the APO, or it decides that, you know, institutions, government institutions should be reformed rather than replaced by alternative institutions, there can be other groups or other bases within the APO that can simply refuse to do so, such as, you know, the indigenous groups, for instance, that run more along the lines of autonomy and Zapatismo and Nagonismo, and have a very strong history in these type of things. And so, you know, what the APO is it's a place to meet, it's a place to organize, and make, you know, whatever collective consensus-based decisions are possible. But when it comes down to it, you know, it will always be the people who are in, you know, in the streets or in their own communities who are making the decisions. And the APO certainly enables people to do that, which is something that's really good about the APO. I know that, you know, anti-authoritarians and anarchists have found a space within the APO, and, you know, they think it's a pretty large space within the APO, and they've been, you know, they've had a long process of how to relate to the APO and to the uprising itself. And what they found is that there's actually like a lot of anarchist tendencies within a lot of groups within the APO. And so even though that there are communists or, you know, people who are members of the PRD party working within the APO, still the anarchists can find a space. And so, you know, it really is a space where people can work on their own views and stuff like this, with their own goals.
Baruca, what does effective solidarity, does that mean in this context right now? What are the effective things that we can do?
You know, there's been a lot of discussion around that, and I think that, you know, I think that Brad's death, you know, it created a situation in which solidarity seemed to be really confusing for a lot of people. And it also kind of like opened up this wound, and solidarity is definitely a difficult, delicate spot right now. You know, people in the north certainly need to be paying attention to what's going on in Oaxaca, not letting, you know, the people of Oaxaca be isolated. And certainly after all this repression and the dispersion of the movement, they need to understand that, you know, Oaxaca has not ended, and that, you know, the movement is still continuing, and that there are still people who are suffering repression, and there are still people who are, and just understanding that nothing has really ended. And also I think that people need to, you know, have some type of analysis and look at themselves and look at each other and, you know, what happened post Brad Will's death, you know, and when it comes down on people locally when, you know, a white person dies. And, you know, the Preventive Federal Police, they did not go, you know, because of the death of Brad Will, but they used the death of Brad Will to justify, accelerate, and permit the entrance of the federal forces. And so, you know, that's really something to look at. And also, you know, the fact that people were dying in Oaxaca long before the death of Brad Will, but yet, you know, there is such strong acts of solidarity and strong direct action that happened after his death. And kind of, you know, look at, like, what that might mean for people in Oaxaca, or what that might look like. it's just like, you know, another thing that we should be questioning and analyzing, you know, and that there should be, you know, these types of protests and these types of solidarity every single time that somebody dies, every single time that there's mass arrests and torture carried out. And, you know, I think that Oaxaca is really just, it's just an example of, you know, what's happening all around the world, you know, with neoliberal policies that are seeking to, you know, exploit natural and human resources and really crush people's lives, you know, and the resistance in Oaxaca is just a response, you know, to people attempting to survive under these conditions. And, you know, if the government is able to, you know, take out Oaxaca, then, you know, after Oaxaca, they're just going to go somewhere else. So Oaxaca is not an isolated situation, but, you know, that it's an example of what's going on all over the world. You know, people certainly need money for the political prisoners. That's, you know, a major issue right now. And people need to be demanding, you know, not only justice for Brad Will, but justice for all the other people killed and, you know, and torture the political prisoners and demand their freedom. I know it's hard to say, and also stay informed and, you know, not let Oaxaca, you know, become isolated. You know, there's been a wall of information, and the government has been certainly, you know, trying to keep the flow of information from leaving Oaxaca. And so, you know, it's really necessary that people keep informed and you know, not let Oaxaca become a blind spot.
You bring an interesting perspective on these things because you have 4 years of experience working with various anti-authoritarian collectives in Mexico. You were in Oaxaca during this uprising. You're currently in Chiapas, where the Intergalactica is going to take place in the next few days. You're also, you know, you come from North America. So how do you see the significance of Oaxaca in light of, say, the rebellion in Chiapas in 1994, in light of the 4 years of work that you've been doing? How does this all fit in?
Well, you know, there's nothing new about Oaxaca. There's nothing new about the repression, and there's nothing new about, you know, about people in Latin America organizing in a horizontal fashion. And, you know, there is definitely has been long a culture of resistance in Mexico, and, you know, a culture of organizing, you know, from below and on an autonomous basis. None of these things are new.